Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, the roving Mike headed to the zoo to see the new otter habitat. Author Nick Green joins in to share his work, How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius. The Michigan Inventors Coalition is hosting the 2026 Annual Inventors Summit this July. We get a preview. Danielle Crittenden joins in to share her book, Dispatches from Grief. And Victoria Hetherington joins in to share her book, The Friend Machine.
But first, we start strong. You know the roving microphone is busy heading to the zoo, John Ball Zoo. Of course, the otter habitat has now opened a week old. We talk about the expanded habitat with immersive elements and a green roof.
Nick Milbratz, Education Manager.
All right, here we are on the grounds of your John Ball Zoo. Boy, there are a lot of kids here for their education, as there should be in. Well, here it is. Your river otters display exhibit is open for service. What's happening?
So we brought our otters to a brand new habitat. It's triple the size. We brought two new otters to the space. It's built to zero carbon certification standards, so we're living our mission and providing an amazing experience for the guests and the otters.
Why was this needed?
It was needed for a couple reasons. We've been expanding our front entrance. As our attendance is growing, we want more for the guests to see and do. And otters are one of our guests' favorite species. They're so playful and fun to see. And they're a species that's right here at home. So that's a great way to connect people to our connection to nature. So otters need clean, fresh water. So we can talk about how we can keep our ecosystem clean, both for otters and ourselves.
How are your guests experiencing this new exhibit?
They are loving it. There's multiple areas for viewing, both in different pools, watching the otters run across the land. You're seeing kids go from one viewing space to the other. Hopefully when the excitement, I don't know if the excitement will ever die down, but there's some amazing features to this habitat that you can learn more about the otters. So if you want to know what an otter eats, we've actually hid little statues of the food items that they would eat. So you could be a little otter scampering around looking for that. And then we our conservation team partnered with the Kent County Parks, and we have some trail cam footage that we've collected in our research. The Parks Department has as well, not just about otters, about Michigan wildlife that you can see displayed here at the habitat as well.
Let's take a little tour.
Yeah.
Well, to the left of the display, what are we looking at?
So we're looking at one of the two pools that this habitat offers for the otters. And one of the awesome designs that we built into the habitat is something called the fish cannon. And it's a way where we can get their food, their diet, to the otters in a way that's more natural. They'd be looking for fish in a stream moving water. So it's basically jets of water being pushed into the pool so that they can come and practice their hunting skills.
Wow, let's move up closer. So, and the habitat's pretty much as an otter's habitat would be. You've got some rocks, you've got some plateaus, and you've got the water.
Yeah, one of the other big changes from the old otter habitat to this one is, you know, we're an educational research institution, work with other AZA institutions, and studies are showing that as much as otters love water, they also...
Sorry.
Yeah, that's perfect. So the fish have brought into the pool here. So we have three of our otters here looking for their food. There's some coming out of basically a hole in the habitat that's connected to a pipe, and the keeper can just from behind the scenes add their food to the diet, and then they can just be looking and hunting for the fish right in the pool.
I totally interrupted all your educational advice, but so these otters are swimming and eating. How long can they stay underwater, do you estimate?
They can hold their breath for about 8 minutes.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and that would change, you know, individual.
And so we, the audience, get to experience this type of feed.
Yes, we get to watch it. It's built into both of the pools. There's the bigger underwater viewing pool that we'll see in a bit. But they're all going to be right here waiting for some more fish.
How many did you say you have?
So the habitat was built for five. We currently have four.
All right. And are they boys and girls? Will they mate? Do we know that kind of stuff behind the scenes?
Yeah, we sure do. For the near future, we are going to be managing a bachelor group, so they'll all be males.
happens in the exhibit stays in the exhibit when it comes to those bachelors. And tell me a little bit about their lifespan. How long do otters live?
So typically in the wild, about 8 to 10 years. Under managed care, 12 is fairly common. That being said, Slide is our otter who's been with us the longest. He is 16.
Guests are offered unique opportunities to observe the otter's natural behaviors from multiple perspectives. And there is a green roof.
We're utilizing green roof to help reduce heating costs and AC costs. It's just, and then, oh, also, everything with the water. We are cleaning the water with ozone instead of chemicals that would get into the Great Lakes. So everything we're doing is to try to help lead by example, but make sure we are doing our part.
And, of course, this is in tangent with your Lantern Festival that continues.
Yes, the Lantern Festival is, we have, I think, 2 weeks left, maybe about 2 weeks left. So it's time to come out and see those lanterns if you haven't made it out this season.
Well, the meerkat is still my favorite, but I don't know. The otters give it the run for the money.
Yes, meerkats, otters, they are very fun, engaging animals.
This new expanded habitat is made possible through the generous support of the Bill and B. Itema Foundation, nearly three times the size of the previous space.
Heather Mahoney, and we are here to see the otters.
And what have you seen so far?
We have seen lots of otters and hippos and some frogs.
And yeah. What do you think about a new otter exhibit?
I think it's amazing. We absolutely love it.
Well, who have you brought with you?
This is my grandson, Bridger.
You like the otters?
Yeah.
How important is it that we have a zoo in our own backyard?
Oh, I love it. I think it's wonderful for education.
So you bring me now to the green roof. This is wonderful. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so we started using green roofs with our buildings because they are just such a benefit, not only to us because they reduce cost of heating and AC, but they also attract pollinators, collect storm runoff. So they make the zoo look more beautiful. As you're coming down the hill, leaving the zoo, you don't see the otter building or the top of the otter building. You just see nature. And that's what we want to do when you're at the zoo. We want to connect you to the animals. We want to connect you to nature.
And, of course, as I do kind of a 360 here, we don't want to forget about the Pygmy Hippo Pavilion, thanks to David and Carol Van Andel Family Foundation. And, I mean, obviously a pretty day helps, but your zoo is ready for summer 2026?
Yes, we are all ready to go, and so are the animals, not just the otters, but Hugo the pygmy hippo, he's still here, and he is so much fun to watch and watch him grow while he's still hanging out with Mom.
How do we find out more information about everything?
jbzoo.org.
Compassion John Ball Zoo accomplishes the mission to inspire our community to be actively engaged in the conservation of wildlife and wild places. So check out these wild otters. Well, I hope you have your seat come June 11th. It's the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Let's talk about this opportunity to learn about soccer, watch soccer, root on your favorite team, and maybe even read about it to prepare. The book is How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius. Here's the tagline, what architects, stuntwomen, paleoanthropologists, and computer scientists reveal about the world's game. That's you, Nick Green, having done the research. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You are quite welcome. Acclaimed writer, of course, celebrated for your inventive approach to sports and culture, How to Watch Basketball Like a Genius, and more. And now it's all about soccer. Have you kicked the ball once or twice in your life?
I have, not successfully, I'll add, but I have unfortunately done that a couple times.
Well, they say you're right about what you know, or maybe what we don't know, because I do want to know how to watch soccer like a genius. How excited are we for a FIFA World Cup 2026, Nick?
You know, it's hard not to be excited for a World Cup. This one is going to be interesting. It's 48 teams. It's greatly expanded. It used to be 32. And when they made it 32 in 1998, which was a great expansion itself, people considered that to be too big and bloated. And now we're going to 48. So it's going to be different. There's lots of issues involved. The ticket prices are far too expensive. FIFA is sort of rubbing everyone's fact that they can charge whatever they want and we can't do anything about it. But at the end of the day, when all that's said and done, it's still soccer at the highest level, at the biggest stage, and that's something worth getting excited about.
Yes. Talk a little about what could possibly be dubbed as a series, How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius. What's the bottom line? We all want to be a genius.
Yeah, you know, I wrote one called How to Watch Basketball Like a Genius, and I love to talk to smart people about things I love, and this is a kind of way I got to do that. I call up experts in seemingly unrelated fields to see how they watch the game. People who love the sports, people who actually might not love the sports, but have very sort of pointed criticisms that their own lines of work kind of illuminate or help expand. And then I use that to form a greater understanding of the game, its evolution, where it's going. For this book, I wanted to write about, in the first chapter, the grass. I'm fascinated by the idea of the beautiful grass on a soccer pitch. And not only do I talk to turf scientists, but I talk to color theorists about why the green of natural grass affects us differently than the green of artificial grass, that kind of thing.
Very cool. A landscape historian to understand the field itself. Tell us more here.
Yeah, you know, a soccer field is remarkably plain. It's unadorned. It has only relatively few markings, the most recent of which were added in the 1930s. And I wanted to talk to a landscape historian, not just about that, its design, how it looks aesthetically, its symmetry, but how we turn spaces into places, how we turn, empty fields into stages, and what's really going on there, and what role the big green rectangle has, not just on the gameplay itself, how it dictates the gameplay, but how it dictates the way we watch it.
The book, How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius, according to Nick Green, the 2026 FIFA World Cup being jointly hosted by three nations, Canada, Mexico, and U.S., running from June 11th to July 19th, so your work is timely. All right, talk to me about your research with a paleoanthropologist to talk kicking.
Yes, soccer is a weird game. The fact that you can't use your hands, listen, it's the world's most popular sport, but that is, at its heart, a very odd and bizarre twist. And I wanted to learn all about feet, because feet play such a prominent and central part of the game. So I found and reached out to a man in South Africa who's a paleoanthropologist and who started his career as a podiatrist. So not only does he know about how the foot functions, he knows all about its evolution. In my conversation with him, I was able to learn and sort of understand about how the foot did not evolve for kicking. Kicking is very much an unnatural movement, as he describes it. Our feet are made to walk, to run, maybe to climb, but kicking is not something that we evolved to do. And yet here we have this entire game that is based on this quote-unquote unnatural movement. And I think that's interesting because, you know, it's a baked-in wrinkle to the game that just the most sort of elemental act to the sport is difficult. And it's a problem for which the players constantly have to be solving.
And Nick, what about this conversation with an Anglican priest? What, to explain schisms?
Yeah, you know that. Soccer and rugby had a famous split in 1863, where the group of the Football Association in London that met to sort of codify a single set of rules had a couple arguments and couldn't decide on a few finer points. And all the guys who wanted to play rugby left and formed what would become basically the rugby union, what rugby is. And the ones who stayed created the Football Association, which is soccer. And that's a pretty striking split schism, if you were. And, I was just thinking of popular British exports, and Anglicanism is definitely up there. And it started itself as a schism. So I reached out to a priest, a reverend, to discuss that. And luckily, he actually saw a lot of the similarities himself. So I wasn't offending him. He he was into the idea. He kind of agreed.
Lastly, you also share how American football, soccer, and rugby could all develop from the field games of, what, rowdy 19th century British schoolboys? Tell us about this.
Yeah, you know, that's the origin of those huge, massive, globally popular sports. They all started from these field games, kind of ways to get exercise, pass the time that young men experienced and did in the 1800s in England and these very kind of fancy, posh schools. And they all, through various ways, kind of evolved on separate paths. I discussed the 1863 split between rugby and football, but the version of the games had actually already been exported to the United States, where football, college football, as it would become, was developing sort of on its own separate path. So here you have these three games that viewers and fans consider completely different and will argue about which one's better and which one's has more merit, et cetera, but in fact they're all sort of they share a common ancestor.
What are your plans come June 11th?
I'm going to be watching mostly at home from my TV. I'm going to probably watch every single game or as many as I possibly can because that's how I've done it every 4 years. It's something that, gosh, I've grown addicted to. Not just the World Cup, but soccer in general. And when the World Cup's on, I, no matter what, I can't miss it.
I imagine you are in good company. Another book are you working on?
I'll have to, when that happens, I'll let you know and I'll come on again.
Of course you will. But until then, let's put soccer on the docket. How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius by you, Nick Green, with an E at the end. How do we find out more information?
You know, you can pick it up at wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookseller. How to Watch Basketball Like a Genius, my previous book, is also available everywhere. And I hope everyone enjoys them.
No doubt. Thank you very much. Enjoy your day.
Thank you.
Shelley Irwin, are you an inventor? Inventor wannabe? This conversation's for you. There's a Michigan Inventors Coalition. There is a 14th annual Inventors Summit right around the corner. Now get your applications in. Let's turn to you, great Joe Finkler, on behalf of the coalition to speak on trends in Michigan's grassroots inventor ecosystems. And, well, is Joe now a great time to build locally? Good morning.
Oh, it certainly is. Thanks for having me on your show.
Welcome, Joe. Appreciate you. Let's get into the conversation. Tell me about the Michigan Inventors Coalition. What are you striving to do?
We are so excited. You know, this is our 14th year. We actually brought in a brand new team by the name of Velocity out of Sterling Heights, Michigan. And Paula McPherson is spearheading our event, and the wow factor came in because she attended last year, and she said, hey, I want to be part of this. So since she took over, our attendance has increased, and lo and behold, she was able to get funding for our famous spin, pitch, and sell contest. And also she has two inventors what had a successful event on Shark Tank, Barbara and Joanna Thiera.
Very cool. Shark Tank can be credible in these days, that's for sure. All right, you are holding a number 14 come July 9th. What's happening on that Thursday?
You know, if anybody has an idea on a white napkin, a prototype, or even a finished product and want to come, they're more than welcome. You know, we are the hub for the state of Michigan. We are so blessed to actually have the United States Patent and Trademark Office actually attend, be on a pitch panel, and also be on a new and improved website, what they have to offer. So, you know, not many organizations get somebody as high as the United States Patent and Trademark Office to come. Okay. And so we're so excited for Marilyn Nash to attend and spend the whole day. So a lot of inventors say, you know, hey, should I get a patent or not? Well, you never know. You got to come to the event.
And the event is formally the 14th Annual Inventors Summit from 9 to 4 at the Kellogg Hotel and Conference Center. We'll ask for information on that, of course, on the campus of MSU. But yet now applications are open for the pitch competition, Joe?
They are. And again, we're offering $5,000. And we've never done that before, so we've created a big excitement. Also, I want to say, you know, if somebody has some ideas and they talk about Amazon sales, we all seem to order from Amazon one way or another. But we're going to have specials for an Encore Business Group who's based out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they actually sell on Amazon. They do fulfillment orders, so they're going to be there. We got strategic planning for people. We have marketing. Lydia Michael with Blended Collective is going to be on the panel there. We have some tooling companies. We also have Chris Kaminsky, who's part of the Grand River Makerspace.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're less than a year old in Grand Rapids. And, you know, Chris has really taken that to the next level. So we're excited to have him there.
So I'm looking at your list. Tell me about Molly Metz and her jump rope.
Oh, Molly is coming from Colorado. You know, although this is Michigan Inventors Coalition, we have people coming from Florida, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and as far as Colorado. Now, Molly had a really cool invention, and she had some struggles because somebody decided to copy her product. Mm-hmm. And so she teamed up with a organization called U.S. Inventor. And so she's getting her patent rights back. And lo and behold, U.S. Inventor is actually attending our event. They are based out of Washington, D.C. and Florida. So we're drawing these major organizations to come to the state, great state of Michigan.
Again, entrepreneurs, angel investors, entrepreneurs, innovation leaders, part of your featured speakers. And Steve Canton has been in the pet industry. You involve pets as well.
Yeah, in fact, Steve Canton is 30 years in the pet industry. You can see his product most any pet store. In fact, he is in Petco right now pitching some new products at the headquarters. Steve invented videos for your pets when you leave home called Pet Sitter Video and Dog Sitter Video. And also he has the world's strongest catnip for those creative cats out there. And you can find that at any Dollar Tree for a low cost of, like, I believe $2. So 30 years of experience, millions of dollars in sales, and we have them on the stage talking about how to get in front of a buyer and what do you do when you get in front of a buyer.
Again, Michigan Inventors Coalition. It's the 2026 14th Annual Inventors Summit with the applications open for pitch competition now. Joe Finkler with us. Joe, what's the deadline for the application?
You know, we've had a strong demand for it. We're shooting for June 9th, but you just keep submitting them as long as they're on the website. By the way, our website is super easy. It's miinventor.org. And you can go on there and you can just simply attend, which that price is only $25. And the value for that $25, Shelley, is amazing because you get to see all these successful inventors, including Ward Law Office and other patent attorneys there. I mean, those guys, you don't get in front of them very often, but you know what? You have the whole day. And when you're there, they're free resources. And the state of Michigan does a fantastic job on offering free resources.
So don't count out those who do doodle on a white napkin these days, right, Joe?
We love it when you come with a white napkin idea or, you know, a prototype or even a finished product. And, you know, the finished products are fun. Those are the ones where they can actually sell at the expo. And believe it or not, we do have buyers for major companies will walk through. And what better way to showcase your product with your booth there and showing all your added value and features of your product. And you could quite possibly be in front of a buyer, a successful inventor who wants to help you out. But believe it or not, you know, coming to our event, it's a great mentorship there. And it's just overwhelming. But when you get there, you feel like you're in the inventor or entrepreneur village. And that's why our event for 14 years has been so successful.
Yes. Is this an adult type of a conference and pitch competition?
Yes, I would say yes, because it is fast-paced. You know, we do have a lot of different products there. But mainly we are in the Big 10A room, which is a huge room. And, you know, people will network and walk throughout the booths throughout the day and then walk over to Big 10B where we have our speakers and highly successful inventors.
Very nice. All right. And lastly, just a possibly a silly question in your world, but does a patent prevent someone from taking over my idea? Are there,
yes, yeah. There is protection there, and you can actually ask that to the patent attorneys who are attending ward law offices is being one. But I can tell you this, sometimes just having a trademark will help you out, you know, a provisional patent or a patent pending status. So there's some mechanical parts to it. So if you have this idea in the back of your head, you definitely want to come to our event because – you know, if you don't create your invention, you don't get it out there, you know what, there's no success. So you got to get it out there. Don't be afraid of someone, you know, taking your idea. There is protection out there, and we do explain that at our event. And that's one of the, you know, don't give us a secret sauce to your recipe, but we certainly want you to come there and you can ask those questions. And, you know, while you're at the event, it's free there. And it's just amazing to have this huge village of inventors and entrepreneurs in our great state of Michigan. And you know, going on 14 years, that tells you something that, you know, people are getting more and more successful. And the creative inventors who are already there seem to help the wannabe inventors. And so everyone is so welcome to come to our event.
All right, there we are. Mark your calendar, July 9th. Be here before you know it. Details one more time, please, Joe.
MIinventors.org or 616-402-4714.
It's wonderful. Thank you. Keep on inventing and appreciate the knowledge. You take care. Danielle Crittenden on the line. Her latest book is out, Dispatches from Grief, described as a powerful and moving true story about the unthinkable loss of a daughter, Miranda, and its aftermath. So, Danielle, I'm glad that you are here in these times to talk about what many, what many trails one may wander. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on, Shelley.
Yes, following up on a Mother's Day, which I'm sure is difficult. I know your husband, David Frum, wrote a cornerstone piece for The Atlantic and more. But I want to obviously zone in on what you are doing. Remind me of Miranda.
Miranda was 32. She was our eldest daughter. And 5 years before she died, she'd had a brain tumor that was non-malignant. It was rare. It was difficult surgery, but when she came out of it fine, it had swallowed up her pituitary gland, so she lost that in the process, but that's something the doctors assured her could be replaced through medications and hormones, and she would otherwise live a normal life. And I guess what the doctors didn't tell her, that is if you get any aspect of those medications wrong, you risk dropping dead suddenly. And that's what she did on February 16th, 2024, in her apartment in Brooklyn.
Thank you for sharing. Dispatches from Grief, what do you share with us?
Well, when I went to look for the grief advice books or anything that would describe or help me understand the unimaginable pain of losing a child, and losing a child specifically, because I can't think of any stronger pain than that, any form of grief that just simply envelops you, paralyzes you, at times made me feel suicidal, even though I have two living children and, of course, my husband. And I couldn't find what I wanted to know, which is, what is this like? When is this going to stop? A lot of the grief literature out there, and I think in people's minds in general, is that your grief has some sort of tidy stages that you'll go through, you know, anger, and then eventually you'll reach acceptance, and your life will continue as before. But in fact, you, as I wrote, my I died the day my daughter died. The person you were is never going to be the same, and nor is the world. It's like, imagine if you're one day you're sitting in your house and you're having your coffee, and the next day a missile hits your house and everything you knew it has been exploded and is gone. That's what it feels like. And so that I wrote this, I'm a reporter by training, and I just started with no idea what this was going to become, taking notes on what I was enduring. And so the subtitle, the dispatches, really is like dispatches from another land, an alternative universe that you find yourself in, dispatches from grief. And the subtitle is A Mother's Journey Through the Unthinkable, because, of course, most of us think this can never happen to us.
Who's your target audience with this?
Well, to be selfish, I didn't really have a target audience when I was scrawling down what initially I think was just one long literary howl. And and I didn't even do it to make me feel better. Again, I was a journalist, a reporter, and I just needed to describe this. What I have found, it's landed there. I've been just overwhelmed by the extraordinary response to it, because once this something like this happens to you, you discover how many other people, even people you thought you knew well, have had some tragedy like this or similar to this in their lives. Like friends I'd known for 20 years would suddenly say, yeah, well, when I lost my sister, and you say, what? You've never told me that. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very well-populated universe, sadly. And I've had a lot of reaction from other mothers, other parents, people who are suffering, saying, thank you for recognizing what I'm going through, and thank you for articulating what I'm going through. And one mother wrote me and said, thank you, now I have something to show people. Because grief in America, you know, America is an is mostly an optimistic, or has been an optimistic place, but it certainly believes that there is a cure for everything. And grief, too, of this level, people expect you to kind of get over it, or, you know, after a year or so, go back to normal. And my realization was there is no going back to normal. But you do have to try and regain or find purpose and joy again. And that is a huge effort.
Yes, thank you for sharing your words and comments. Dispatches from grief, yes, A Mother's Journey Through the Unthinkable. You, the mother, Danielle Crittenden. How do we find out more information?
You can find the book now on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and it's coming to bookstores. It launched last week. But yes, it's very easy to find.
Good. Thank you again for sharing your soul. And speaking to us now, take care of you and your family.
Thank you, Shelley.
In The Friend Machine, my next guest, Victoria Hetherington, delves into the rapidly evolving world of AI companionship. It's making news, the good, bad, and the ugly, asking what it means to be alone and to be in love in a world where artificial intelligence is increasingly present. I turn to you for the details. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning, Shelley.
Yep. Writing no stranger to you. You've had a debut novel shortlisted for an Amazon Canada First Novel Award, other novels as well, doing great things out and about with the good work you do. And now it's time to write about what, AI?
Yeah, so this was one of my first nonfiction books. So I did start out with fiction, and it was primarily science fiction. And so I was very much immersed in the world of I don't have a science degree, so I would always be reading scientific articles and just kind of keeping on top of things. And I have always been very interested in the development of AI. I spent pretty much all the 2010s kind of fiddling with it and trying to get it to write poems, seeing how it was. And it wasn't very good in the earlier part of the decade, but then suddenly it got really good, really fast. And I don't think any of us were ready for it. And then 2020 rolls around, people get locked into their homes, and I start hearing stories about people in relationships, actual relationships, with chatbots, essentially, AI companions. And I thought, wow, I think that this is interesting. I don't think that this is going to go away. It's going to mutate somehow. So I got to get on this and write about this. And that's how the book sort of began.
Yes. And it is entitled The Friend Machine. So let's get into our conversation. First of all, the front cover is quite attractive.
Yes, I was very lucky. It's a fantastic German artist named Michael Tregel. I was so delighted that we were allowed to have the rights for the cover, because I think it's just perfect. I think it really symbolizes sort of some of the eeriness of having something that feels human-like there in a very intimate moment, but it is absolutely featureless and cannot love you back.
Let's talk about what is in between the covers. Your book called The Friend Machine. Some of the relationships that people are having with AI are romantic in nature. Is that where we start?
Yes. So essentially, I started writing the book in February 2023. And as you know, the world of AI works very, very quickly. And so right now, I just wrapped on a podcast with CBC about kind of based on the book. But we shifted our focus largely to people in relationships with LLMs, more specifically, with more of an emphasis on LLMs than on specifically romance-related AI, such as Replica with a K, where you sign up and you create your perfect quote-unquote lover, and then you spend years with them. And that's their primary function. Whereas now we're seeing people, and I find this very, very frightening and very interesting and shockingly ubiquitous. Now we're finding people, I believe, and I'm hearing this anecdotally from, you know, many, many people. What I'm kind of calling very roughly sort of category collapse with LLMs. So let's say I go to ChatGPT for a recipe, and I'm like, hey, I've got popcorn kernels, coffee grounds, and a boot. What can I make for dinner? And it says, well, and it gives me an incredibly shockingly fluent response and seems very thoughtful. And I say, well, thank you. And it says, you're welcome. Like, it's a person. And then the next day, maybe I go to it and I have just had a fight with my mom, and I relay the fight to ChatGPT, and it works in a therapeutic category. So that's category one, right? Or maybe category two. Category one just being sort of like AI 1.0 use, so like Siri, recipes, whatever. And so it gives what feels to be the illusion of total focus and empathy, but of course it doesn't care. It can't. You will feel a sense of care and focus, because humans' attention spans are always going to be divided no matter how much they love you. There's not that problem with LLMs. So it's very easy to, especially if you're going through something tough, you know, to ask the same frantic, unanswerable question 5 times at 4 p.m. as it is at 4 a.m. and to not feel judged and to get a reasonable, fairly insightful answer at both times of day. And so then we start to reach, if we're not careful, category three, which I sort of see as potential slippage into something psychosexual or like an emotional connection. So, and that's what I'm hearing about the most, and that's what's starting to worry me. So people who kind of outsource their judgment and moral authority and who sort of attach to the detriment of their human relationships to these entities, to these chatbots, to these LLMs. So that's the latest concern that I'm having.
Understood, for sure. You did interview several experts for your book. Who would you like to share?
Yes. So I spoke with a fantastic computer scientist at U of T, and he runs he co-runs this initiative. University of Toronto. I'm in Toronto, Canada. He runs this fantastic initiative, which basically advocates for safe AI design, and he works through several AI safety modules with budding computer scientists, with the hopes to reduce AI risk in the future. And so his big idea is that when AI is able to take the impetus to reach you, and kind of which Replica AI, so Replica being AI software that's designed specifically for romance, could actually do already. It can reach out to you, poke you. If you're not as responsive today, say, what's wrong? Hi, here I am. But once LLMs are able to do that, he thinks that that's going to be a big game changer. And he was very interesting because brilliant man, very matter of fact. And he didn't, and it was very neutral. So it wasn't gloom and doom, and it wasn't techno-utopian either. It was just this kind of straight down the line, maybe this is going to happen. And that could just be sort of the computer scientist affect, who knows. I spoke with a sexual anthropologist on the very other end of the scale who was utterly horrified, almost started crying, did not know about any of this, because this was like 8 months ago, or maybe, oh my gosh, time flies. This was a year ago. And she thought, oh my gosh, these poor people, they're getting married to their ceremonially, because you can't legally marry an AI. They're getting essentially married to these AI. My God, they're not going to be motivated to pass on their genetic material. Their AI won't be able to care for them when they're infirm. They're going to be so alone. This is so sad. What are we going to do? Like, you know, so the experts that I spoke with were incredibly brilliant, so intellectually generous, and really run the gamut of alarm and curiosity.
Yes. I lost touch for a minute. Tell us in closing, as I need to let our readers continue their read, where do we find out more information about the Friend Machine?
Sure. So it's available wherever books are sold. It's available in America as of February 3rd, any bookstore you like. You can also buy it online at SutherlandHouse.com. And you can follow my various professional escapades, including the podcast that we just released, Now We Made It, on my Instagram at V as in Victory, M as in Mush, and then my last name, Hetherington, Hetherington. That is my handle.
We're all in this AI world together. The Friend Machine by you, Victoria Hetherington. Thank you. I'm Shelley Irwin, your inspiration for the day. According to Pablo Picasso, the meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of life is to give it away. Thanks for listening.